listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why some Democratic women are stepping up to run for office after the election.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Yesterday, Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction released report cards gauging performance at all of the state's schools and school districts. Those report cards showed 5 districts and 99 schools in the failing category.
Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday, to talk about this and other top stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be here.
So why did the state release these report cards?
So this is part of the state's kind of, it's intended as an accountability measure for schools, and it's by design, it's public. You can go on the State Department of Public Instruction's website and look up how your kid's school or your neighborhood school is doing. The report cards measure student achievement, improvement on tests, progress made in closing racial achievement gaps, which is a very acute problem in Wisconsin, and there are some other measures like attendance rates and how the school does in preparing for students for college or career.
And how did the grades look this year?
So they are mostly quite good. I mean, I guess the headline would be that 82% of public schools were meeting or exceeding expectations. The state looked at a bit over 2,100 schools, and so that's how that shook out. There were then 243 schools that rated meets few expectations, and 99 schools that had the lowest rating failed to meet expectations. And it's not really, it's really not rocket science. The schools that struggle are the schools where there is a high level of poverty, and these things are very highly correlated, and I think we've known this for a long time. And this shows it again, though it's probably notable that this year's report card had some measures that are meant to control for that, or not just simply be a measure of poverty, but also because they're looking at progress and how students have changed over the course of the year, rather than just a flat comparison of like a rich district to a very poor district.
Any major changes or trends between this year and last year?
So it's hard to say. It's a little, for that exact reason, it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison. There was no school report card last year because Wisconsin has really been burning through some different assessments. This is the third assessment test in 3 years. Maybe that's not quite right, but it's changed a lot. So they didn't have an assessment last year, so this is the first one since the 2013-14 school year, and some of the measures are different now. So it's not quite an exact comparison, but I mean, really, what we're looking at is what you want to know is that in general, the schools seem to be meeting expectations, and then you want to look at where the problem areas are. They are in some poor Milwaukee neighborhoods and in high poverty districts in other cities around the state.
And Rob, before we move on to our next story, what happens if a school gets one of these failing grades? Is there any action taken?
So it is significant that Milwaukee Public Schools went from, in the last report that was issued, from failing to meet expectations to the one step higher than that, meets few expectations, which does stave off like a takeover or some rather more drastic measures that could be taken. And so there was definitely a possibility of some potential for heavy consequences on Milwaukee, and that looks like for this year that is no longer the case.
Rob Menser is with us now for our Wisconsin State News Roundup, and we're talking about the biggest stories out this week. And Rob, there was a breaking news about Brendan Dassey, who was part of the documentary Making a Murderer. What happened?
Sure. Brendan Dassey, of course, was the the nephew of Stephen Avery, and Dassey with Avery was convicted of the rape and murder of Teresa Halbach in 2005. So in August, Dassey, who was just a teenager, he's just a 16 years old, I think, at the time of the crime, was his conviction was overturned in August. This week, on Monday, a federal judge granted his lawyer's request that he be set free while the case is being appealed. The state is going forward with an appeal. On Tuesday, Wisconsin asked that judge to stay his decision. He declined to do so. And so prosecutors filed an emergency motion with a higher court, with an appeals court. And then on Thursday, the appeals court agreed that, that the state agreed with Wisconsin, with the state Department of Justice, that Dassey will stay in prison while the appeal proceeds. So we end the week where we began it with Dassey still in prison, but yeah, for a, you know, there's this weird back and forth, and for a while I know my colleague Allison Durr of the Appleton Post Crescent was out, you know, standing outside the federal prison waiting for Dassey to possibly be released.
So what
they
happens?
Have to wait a little longer.
What happens with this appeal? How soon could that be sorted out? Would there be some sort of decision there?
It could be years yet. I mean, so the basis of the appeal is that in the interrogation, Dassey, who again was just a child, and Dassey has some cognitive challenges. Police essentially lied to Dassey in the interrogation. They made false promises to him. And for those who watched Making a Murderer, it certainly appears quite obvious that he did not understand what he was agreeing to when he signed his confession. Now, that doesn't make him innocent. It certainly doesn't make Stephen Avery innocent. But it raised those questions. That was what the judge initially saw reason to overturn that conviction. And so this is it will go on. I think I would not expect a outcome soon. But the questions it raises are serious and have bigger implications.
Is it unusual for the state to step in and ask for an emergency measure, say in this case, to keep Dassey in prison, in jail?
So the state is going to advocate for it's the state is going to be understandably reluctant, I guess, or you could argue, to say that a conviction that it obtained should be overturned and that we should and that somebody who was convicted should be freed. That's going, you know, these are prosecutors. That's going to be their sort of default setting. I don't know of anyone who was surprised that the state sort of took a maximalist action on trying to quash the judge's order.
And finally, this week, former Wisconsin Congressman and U.S. Defense Secretary Melvin Laird passed away this week. He was 94. Can you tell us a little bit about his career?
Yeah, Melvin Laird, a prominent central Wisconsinite. He was from Marshfield, Wisconsin, and someone that Marshfield is very, very proud of. So he was a congressman in the 50s and in the 60s, and then really made his mark on national politics as defense secretary under President Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1973. This was a busy time to be defense secretary. The Vietnam War was going on, and Laird oversaw major changes in the department. The most significant being finally ending the Vietnam War. Laird also oversaw the end of first the draft deferment program for those drafted in the Army, and then eventually the end of the draft itself and the creation of the all-volunteer military that we have today.
And here's a little bit of Laird himself on CBS's Face the Nation in 1971. He's talking about efforts for a negotiated resettlement or settlement in Vietnam.
They should be negotiated in Paris, not in the Congress of the United States, not on television or newspaper columns. It has to be done by the negotiators that are designated by the governments themselves. And that's the way to bring about a negotiated settlement.
Melvin Laird there. And Robert, what kind of legacy does he leave behind in central Wisconsin and beyond?
So Laird, beyond his contributions in the Defense Department and within the Nixon administration, where at times he was, it should be said, he was he favored, you know, de-escalation in Vietnam, and sometimes pushed Nixon and Henry Kissinger for faster troop withdrawals and so on. But he also was a major proponent of healthcare and scientific research, and one of his big there's stuff named after him, and here in central Wisconsin there's the Melvin R. Laird Center for Medical Research at the Marshfield Clinic. He has a Laird room at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, and I think a lot of that reflects some of the work that he did on scientific issues and promoting some of those healthcare science.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us every Friday to talk about the top state news stories from the past week. Democrats lost big last Tuesday when Republican Donald Trump won the race for the White House. For some voters, having the first woman at the top of a major party ticket made the loss even more personal.
One response to the election outcome, a spike of interest post-election day at Emerge Wisconsin. The organization trains women interested in running for office on the Democratic ticket. In the first 2 days after the election, Emerge fielded 18 inquiries.
Erin Forrest joins us now. She's the executive director at Emerge Wisconsin. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, Erin, what would you say that the candidacy of Hillary Clinton meant to Democratic women in Wisconsin?
It was a huge deal. It meant a lot to me personally. I think that there were some differences between how different generations of women felt, and I think there was actually some science that backed that up, that said that older women who had experienced more sexism in their lives and in the workplace were able to relate a little more easily. But I talked to many, tons of women from many different backgrounds, and all of them were excited to see even just the nomination was historic. And it meant a lot.
And on Emerge Wisconsin, what is your sense there about how Hillary Clinton supporters, particularly women, are handling that loss?
So that is also a range. And I think that, there were a lot of people who were very shocked because this wasn't the outcome that they expected. And people react to that in different ways. Some people were immediately ready to act. Some people, it's the stages of grief, I think, came into play for a lot of people. It certainly did for me. So some people were ready to act and organize and immediately try to fix something that they saw as having gone sort of terribly wrong. And other people are taking a little longer to sort of get back up.
And so at Emerge Wisconsin, this is, I guess, sort of busy season for you. It sounds like right now is when you've been gathering applicants for your next class of women who want to run for office as a Democrat. What kind of response did you see there after the election with Hillary Clinton losing?
So in the, a little more than a week and a half since the election, we've had more applications come in than were started in the period before that, which was September, the beginning of September through Election Day. So they've more than doubled.
So what does that represent, do you think?
I think that it a lot of women felt like this was a call to action. They felt like they needed to do more in their communities and that they could and should run for public office. And this will be the 11th traditional cohort that we've trained. We've been doing it for a long time and have been very successful. So I feel pretty grateful that so many of them saw our program as a path to that.
Why do you think there is such a gender gap when it comes to women running for office of either political party or any stripe?
So that's that can be a long conversation, but part of it is when we're very young, there is no gap in political ambition between boys and girls. And then around puberty, we see this dramatic drop in the self-esteem of girls. So across the board, and political ambition falls with that. So by the time kids graduate from high school, there's a gap between a desire to run for office between boys and girls that never goes away. And there are a lot of very nuanced reasons that that happens, but it's something we see pretty consistently across the board. And it's not that women aren't equally motivated to try to change the world. They're just more likely to go into charity work or other paths other than elected office.
Well, you're trying to turn that around. I mean, just, I know we're speculating here and we don't have research, but what do you think happens between junior high and the end of high school to turn that around?
The fundamental societal change, is that too much to ask for? There are a lot of programs that are designed to combat that. Girls who keep playing sports, and team sports in particular, you don't see as big of a gap. Girl Scouts does a lot of work around leadership and bravery for girls. So there are programs that are designed to address it, but I think it's really fairly new. It wasn't all that long ago, in the grand scheme of things, that this really wasn't an option for women. Women running for office wasn't something that really happened. So the research on it is fairly new, and so are a lot of the solutions.
We're talking with Erin Forrest right now, Executive Director of Emerge Wisconsin. It's an organization training Democratic women to run for office. And she's with us to talk about a recent spike in interest after this year's presidential election. And is there any indication that on the spectrum of political ideologies that more Republican or more Democratic women are interested in running for office? Or is it just that women in general are needing more encouragement?
So women in general need more encouragement. There are things like the confidence gap that I don't think have ever been studied by party, but basically if there's a job application that lists 10 qualifications that are needed to apply, men will apply when they meet 6. Women won't apply until they meet all 10. So there are a lot of things that are obviously broad and don't apply to every woman, but are have nothing to do with partisanship. One thing, it is still easier for Democratic women to get elected than Republican women. That's not something we see in Wisconsin as much, but the broader research shows that it's still an easier path for Democrats. And when women run for legislative office, they're just as likely to win as a man. This is a supply problem, not a demand problem. Executive office is a little more problematic, but this is women opting out of running. When they run, they win.
So do you think there's anything about, I know Jesse O'Poin from the Capital Times, we had her on the show before the election, and she talked about some of the issues that seem a little more stark for women, harassment, comments on appearance, threat, maybe sexual-related harassment, that kind of thing for women running. So are you saying it's not some of those things? Or what are you saying?
Oh, sure. No, it's those things, too. My point to the women we train is it's not like you get to avoid those things if you don't go into politics, right? Women get sexually harassed in every workplace. Women, we face those challenges no matter what. Sure, in politics it can happen in a different, more public, sort of scarier way, but you don't get a pass on those if you don't go into politics. And the other part of that is in terms of media coverage. I certainly saw a lot of stuff that was problematic in the way that Hillary Clinton was covered. But there's a lot of research that shows that is not true when people are running for Congress or state offices, and certainly not for local office. You get asked more obnoxious questions like, who's taking care of your kids right now, that men never get asked, and sometimes there's a little more appearance stuff, but that it's really not as bad when you're not running for federal office.
What kinds of things do you teach the applicants at Emerge that you think they need to know?
So we do, it's a 6-month cohort-based training, so it's extensive and it's long-term. And we start out with them sort of getting to know each other and bonding as a cohort, and they start digging into their stories and how to connect that to how they run for office. We train on field and talking to voters, the voter contact and campaign planning part of it. We talk about media and messaging, and in that we talk about earned media and letters to the editor, so doing radio interviews, doing TV interviews, debates and forums and how you prepare for those. We talk about diversity and cultural competency. We talk about fundraising. And then we do the last weekend is a graduation and a celebration, but it's also a training on ethical leadership. And then they also get to spend a morning shadowing female legislators at the Capitol.
Are there any past graduates of the program who have gone on to make successful bids for office?
Oh, yes. So we have over 70 alums who are currently serving in public office, and that doesn't count boards and commissions. It's anyone who's elected, so school boards, city councils, and we also have 7 women serving in the state legislature. So Senator LaTanya Johnson was just elected to the seat that Senator Nakia Harris-Dodd held in the state Senate, and they're both Emerge alums. And then we have quite a few in the Assembly as well.
And just super briefly, we're almost out of time. Anything you'll do differently now, having watched 2016 and this election unfold?
Yes, but I'm not going to know exactly what it is until we have all of the data back. So we're absolutely going to be making some changes, but we're going to be basing them off the best information we can get. And we're also going to be adding some more programming to handle all of these women, because I certainly don't want to turn any women away this year. But we're going to have to sort of see who all applies and figure out how we can, you know, make it work for them.
Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Erin Forrest, Executive Director of Emerge Wisconsin, an organization training Democratic women to run for office. And she was with us to talk about recent spike in interest after this year's presidential election.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, Ken and his guests look back at some of the biggest presidential successes and failures in American history. That's coming up, plus a lot more, tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, anyone who's spent time on social media knows about Twitter trolls and others who like to post offensive content or harass other users. Some people may have gotten familiar with the block or report buttons as well.
Harassment and hate speech on Twitter got extra attention after Saturday Night Live actress Leslie Jones announced she would shut her account down after receiving numerous racist tweets following her performance in the Ghostbusters remake. And also recently, the Anti-Defamation League reported a major increase in anti-Semitic death threats towards Jewish journalists during the past election cycle.
Twitter recently banned some accounts and this week rolled out expanded features aiming to curb harassment. Katie Culver joins us now. She's director for the Center for Journalism Ethics and assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we get into some of the specific new changes that have come along, can you just talk about the problem of harassment on social media? Twitter seems to be one of the big ones. How big a problem are we seeing?
We're seeing a big problem, and one of my concerns is that we're seeing a growing problem. So people over the last 6 months seem to have been emboldened. We have an increase in anti-Semitic tweets, particularly aimed at journalists. The Anti-Defamation League has a pretty disturbing report out, and it shows a rise, and it shows a real boldness to some of the rhetoric that's out there.
Right. Just to get a sense of some of the things, there are tweets directed again at Jewish journalists, often after criticism or articles unfavorable to Donald Trump. Things like you'll be put back in the ovens after Trump is elected, and then images editing the journalist's picture into what looks like a concentration camp oven. We've seen not just in the political world, but things directed at women with death threats and rape threats over time. This is not just mean-spirited stuff. This is pretty horrific stuff we're seeing.
Right. I mean, it's not all this horrific. Mm-hmm. There is the merely mean-spirited, although I don't exactly like that adjective. Mm-hmm. But the worst of it is absolutely shocking to the senses, I think.
And so what are we seeing now from social media organizations? Let's start with Twitter in particular. There's been a lot of criticism for them, not new, not just this year, but over the years, for them not being proactive enough to deal with harassment of their users.
So Twitter has been criticized, and I would argue rightly so, for not doing anything. You know, they have considered themselves to be the freest of free speech outlets, but part of what that misses is that for all of us to have free speech, we can't have harassment and intimidation among some of us. So they held off for quite some time, and under tremendous pressure, tremendous mounting pressure, have finally started introducing some new tools. Some people are skeptical about what those tools will accomplish, whether they're actually dealing with the speech itself or merely shielding some of us from that speech.
Right. They've done things like allowing a user to mute is the word that's used sometimes, even though it's not an audio
right.
thing, but to block out, to not see things that are directed at them, as I understand it.
Right. So that if things are coming at you, you can mute it and not be confronted by it constantly. But that doesn't mean that the speech still isn't out there. I think it's a step in the right direction. But I also think the rest of us as individual Twitter users have a responsibility to rise and respond as well. This is not just Twitter's problem. It's a problem for the entire community that uses Twitter.
And there's a debate over, as you mentioned, the freest of free speech concept. People worried that Twitter might go overboard in banning accounts. There are gray areas quickly rise in deciding what is and what isn't appropriate, who gets banned. Is there a reasonable way for a company like Twitter to draw the line?
I think that finding that line is going to be difficult, but I don't think that means we shouldn't continue to try to find that line. First of all, we have to be very careful in talking about free speech rights. You know, this is a private company. We have no First Amendment rights where Twitter is concerned. Twitter gets to put out a platform in any way that it wants to put out a platform. And if they want to restrict hateful messages that are purely hateful, fine. If they want to restrict hateful messages that are politically motivated, that's their option as well. You know, there's an interesting analogy to be drawn with Instagram. You know, I have the right under the First Amendment to share pornography. The government can't shut me down. If I share obscenity, that's a different matter. The government can't shut me down. But Instagram, of course, can shut me down. There's no reason Instagram would ever allow that on their platform. And so that's the line that Twitter is trying to walk here. How can we control what's damaging the platform that we have? And make sure that this is a place that everyone can participate and not be harassed and abused.
Talking to Katie Culver from UW-Madison. She's director of the Center for Journalism Ethics there. And Katie, it's social media is a different kind of thing. And I often struggle with trying to come up with analogies to, say, a newspaper or something like that. Is Twitter a newspaper equivalent and it has full responsibility for the content on it? Or is it like the paper mill that makes the paper, they would have no responsibility for the content that ends up in the newspaper. Is that part of the difficulty? We can't really conceptualize what a social media platform is and what its responsibilities are?
Yeah, I do think that's part of the problem. We're charting new waters here. We don't know exactly what this should look like. And part of what has sort of hindered us here is that we've been too accepting of treating these social networks like common carriers. So if I harass you over the phone, the phone company really has nothing to do with that. And that's kind of the argument that we've made about a lot of these platforms, that Facebook has no responsibility for fake news because it's just merely a platform. That's not really the way that we can look at it anymore. Of course Facebook has a responsibility for trending fake news on its platform. And it has effects. When we have this kind of hate speech on Twitter or fake news on Facebook, there are effects, and we need to look at those as we try to understand how we can monitor these platforms and how we can act, both as the platforms themselves, but also as users on those platforms.
In the past, we've heard things on social media and on newspaper comment platforms, things like that, ideas like the community will police itself. that seems to have worked poorly in most cases. Then we've heard ideas like, well, algorithms. We'll have these algorithms that'll fix the fake news issue. We'll have these sort of automated reporting systems. Is the answer really that a social media site needs more humans evaluating complaints of harassment in real time as they come in?
I think the answer is that we need a combination of all of those things. We do need to empower the users, and in part that's what the mute button does, and also a clearer path to reporting abuse is part of what Twitter announced this week. That's also an important step, so that we as users can help with policing our own platform. But I do think if we learn from outlets that have done the newspaper or the news story commenting systems right, we learn that human editing is important. So the New York Times found that they employ people to monitor their comments, and they put through comments that they see of value, and they trash comments that they think are not valuable. And they found over time that the people who were trolls, who were adding hateful comments, who were spiteful, who were, you know, engaging in ad hominem attacks, those people just stopped commenting because their comments weren't going through. That doesn't happen with an algorithm. That doesn't happen merely with users reporting. It happens with a set of people making judgments about what is and is not okay in this space.
One argument in the Anti-Defamation League report, and from a lot of people talking about this, is whatever the social media platform does, Facebook, Twitter, whoever, they'd like to see more transparency from them. So we know how fake news is being blocked or not. We know how an account might be banned or a tweet or comment blocked. How important is that transparency issue?
I think that transparency is critical, and I think that's part of what Twitter has been rightly criticized for, is that when people have reported abuse, at some points they get back an automated message that says, your report has been declined. We do not deem this to be a violation of our terms of service. There's no indication of why that is, and in some cases, the communications in question have just absolutely been a violation of the terms of service. And then when news media begin to look into it, you know, say BuzzFeed may question Twitter, all of a sudden Twitter reverses course and says, oh, actually, that is a violation of our terms of service. So not only telling us what is and is not acceptable, but how do we report it and what happens when we do report it? Those are all critical things. If Twitter is going to maintain a platform that people want to engage with and not become sort of this Wild West cesspool.
On the most extreme end of this, when we're talking about actual threats or perceived threats of violence, how hard is that for the legal authorities to tackle when that threat might come from a person next door or a person in Moldavia?
Well, I mean, the threat question is a very important question, and how we can identify who users are and immediately connect with whether this is an incitement, whether a person is in danger. We saw that a lot with Gamergate, which was a sort of, I don't even know how to describe it, actually, a firestorm on social media, particularly on Twitter, where you had threats being made, but claims that, well, of course, it's not really a threat because I am 1,000 or 100,000 miles away from the person that I am targeting. So we really do have to be careful about what constitutes an actual threat and not shutting down speech unnecessarily by the intervention of law enforcement.
We're talking to Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics and assistant professor at UW-Madison, talking about social media sites and harassment and anti-harassment policies, especially at Twitter, which just rolled out some new tools aimed at preventing harassment.
And we want to hear from you. Have you or someone you know ever dealt with Twitter trolls or other harassment on social media? How did you deal with it? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you think social media sites like Twitter should be doing something to protect users from harassment. And how do you think Twitter needs to balance free speech with protecting its users? Again, our number 800-642-1234.
We're picking up our conversation with Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics, assistant professor at UW-Madison, looking at online harassment, threats, and hate speech on social media.
And we want to hear from you. Have you or anyone you know been affected by harassment on social media? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think social media sites should be doing, if anything, to protect their users. Do you worry about new restrictions leading maybe to censorship? If you're a person that monitors monitor social media posts for your group or your organization. We also want to hear about that experience, too. Tell us who you think people should be required to keep conversations civil. Again, our number, 800-642-1234.
And we'll go right to our callers now. Robert is with us in Lake Geneva. Robert, hi.
Hi. So I actually play this this online game. And sometimes when you're playing this game, there's a lot of very toxic people. You know, they might be upset with you or swearing at you or just saying really mean things. And so after every game, you're allowed to report a person, or, you know, if they were doing something like that, you can report them. Anyone can do that. And after so many reports, Riot, the team that develops this game, takes a look at that individual and tries to determine, you know, does this person need to be banned? So I'm wondering, maybe that could be applied to social media somehow.
Robert, thanks for the call. You mentioned the world of gaming earlier, Katie. Been struggling with these issues for a while, or not struggling with them in some cases. Are there lessons to be learned there?
I think there are lessons to be learned there, both to the good and to the bad. So what the caller described is something where the game developers have actually made an investment in trying to have a positive community experience for the gamers within that platform. And when I say investment, that it requires resources to follow up on what people have said, to see when we're getting to a critical mass of complaints about a user, and whether those complaints are related to the user's actual behavior, or are they targeting a user for something not related to behavior? So, you know, it's a very good approach to doing this, but it's an approach that comes at a cost. And unless these platforms are willing to spend resources, they're not going to have that kind of community response.
Robert, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Katie, what does it say about us that when we go into the online world, so many of us, or at least enough to make a visible difference, are participating in this kind of behavior, walking on the streets, looking at people you maybe wouldn't think it would be this bad this quick?
It hasn't been all that quick, actually. You know, I mean, from pretty much from the introduction of bulletin boards as a means of accessing the internet, we've seen some pretty disgusting speech unleashed. So this has been going on for quite some time. But what it says to us is that these feelings are out there, even if we don't see them in our day-to-day world. And so it's important to not get complacent. It's important to remember that we have things like racism. We have things like homophobia. We have rampant misogyny in some areas, and we need to confront it. That's one of the arguments in favor of free speech, is that you don't cut off hateful speech because you need to know it's out there and you need to counteract it. Unfortunately, I think as a culture, we have been too lax in counteracting it. We stop the conversation at someone has a right to be offensive, and we don't continue the conversation into we all have a responsibility to counteract that offensive speech.
But is there a risk that we're normalizing it? We talked to Brian Levin, who studies hate groups, and he said, you know, maybe the person who had neo-Nazi sympathies but was the only person in their town who did was a loner back then. Now they're empowered by having this community online.
Right. You feel like you have this sense of community. And I think that's part of the reason that Twitter has acted this week to cancel some of the alt-right accounts. So that, you know, people who were claiming, well, this is just a political movement, Twitter has come out and said, as an organization, we believe that this is not an acceptable political movement, and you will not use our platform to try to galvanize this kind of hatred, because you're galvanizing it from maybe one or two loners within a whole bunch of different communities, but they found a psychographic community online, and that psychographic community can gain power.
Let's go back to our callers. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I understand the conversation about Twitter, and I'm not really that avid of a user, but I recently, maybe about 6 months ago or so, started chiming in on Reddit, and I'm surprised this hasn't come up or anybody else has called in, because I've never seen such hate speech from people that I have on that platform. I was chiming in on something. I don't remember. I put a comment that, you know, disagreed with somebody, and somebody told me, I mean, they don't know me, but they told me they hoped that I died and burned in hell. I was like, wow, you know, I've never had that before on Facebook or Twitter, so I just thought I would add that. Thanks.
John, thanks for bringing that up. And Reddit, another platform that there are some perfectly friendly, innocuous things, it seems like. And then a lot of really hateful things. There's also the 4chan community getting a little more obscure. Katie, can you talk about some of those that maybe people who use Facebook or even Twitter might not be familiar with?
Right. And I think I'm really glad that John raised that point, because it connects perfectly to the point that you raised earlier, which is, how can we find these communities of hatred if we don't have them within our geographic communities? How do we find them online? And I think 4chan and Reddit are really extreme behavior is happening in some parts of those. Now, that's not to say that's exclusively what those platforms are about. There are good things that happen on Reddit, but there are times where people feel so emboldened by the anonymity that they have on Reddit and 4chan that they say things that would just be completely beyond the pale of saying in society when your identity is known.
Thanks for the call, John. We're talking to Katie Culver from UW-Madison, looking at social media harassment, hate speech, and efforts to rein those things in. Teresa joins us next in Racine. Teresa, hi.
Hi there. I think if we start censoring in any way what people are saying, it kind of leads to disempowerment. You know, people really want to have a place to speak their truth and talk about what's upsetting them. So I think that they feel that place in Twitter and social media and other places. But I also think that we as the we don't need to hide from what those posts are, but we need to police our own comments and people making comments on posts that we make. We just need to call people out and say, you know what, I think that's kind of hateful, and I'm going to delete that comment.
Teresa, thanks for the call. So answer speech with more speech, Katie.
Yeah, and I think Teresa has a valid point, and I think that is something that we've been classically bad at, policing speech with more speech. If you look at the example of the noose costume at Camp Randall, you know, we had someone who raised it on social media saying, this is unacceptable to me. And then we had kind of a lackluster response from this community, not a lot of people speaking out that this was unacceptable. This violated the standards of our community. And yes, you have a free speech right to engage in that, but we are not going to accept it. We're not going to stand for it. We're going to counter it. I think that there are times within my own social networks that I call people out about comments, but some of what we're talking about here is far more toxic than would ever appear in my social media networks. You know, my friends on Facebook would not make these comments. If you look to Reddit and 4chan and some of this sort of dark side of Twitter, it really does confront your senses, some of what is being said.
Katie, as we start to wrap up, what would you hope to see in the coming year or two on social media? What would be your top priorities?
I'd like to see, first and foremost, more people engaged in answering speech. I'd like to see the platforms themselves trying to figure out what are ways that we can address this. That's not to say they're going to get it right the first time or every time or a solution is going to come tomorrow, but we still have to keep trying. I also think we need to start to look at what are the roots of this hatred beyond just the speech. What's underlying this, and how can we address that as communities? How can we get at the problem before it begins to mushroom on social networks?
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a great discussion. Your callers are really, really smart.
We do like them. Thank you for your calls today, too. That was Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics, assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about anti-harassment measures on social media after Twitter rolled out some new tools to prevent harassment this week. Still time to share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.